guest at the workshop and very ably took the position of the devil's advocate and started out by saying that the local government article was a disaster area purely for the purposes of creating dialogue, and he did it with tongue in cheek and did it very well. And it did create some good dialogue in the workshop. The crying need seems to be in the suburban areas of the state and the rural areas. The two things that are needed in order to implement local government are money and action by the state legislature sitting as the borough assembly. As some of you will recall, when the first borough was formed in the state of Alaska, Jack Hoghill, then a member of the legislature, attempted to have the rest of the state of Alaska declared as an unorganized borough immediately. He didn't prevail at that time, but it seems in retrospect that possibly that should have happened and that local government would have moved along a great deal faster throughout the whole state than it has moved. The final comment that I have to make about the local government article is that the permanent fund was discussed a little bit in relation to the money concept that is needed in local government areas, and it was felt that by some, myself included, that the permanent fund should not be set up at this time, that the money that is going to go into the permanent fund should be used to develop the local government areas throughout the state, and particularly the suburban areas, before a permanent fund would be necessary. All in all, I think that the consensus of the panel and the workshop was that 20 years is a short time to view what has happened in local government throughout the state, and that it would possibly take another 20 years before an assessment of what the success of the local government article is in the state.
Thank you, Jim, for your report on local government. Pleased to have with us this morning, too, the chairman of the Finance and Taxation Workshop, Eric Woolforth. Eric's an attorney and a former State Commissioner of Revenue. Eric, would you come forward?
Thank you, Governor Bill. The article, taxation and finance article, is brief, and I'll try to be relatively brief in my summary of, I think, the very interesting review session we had yesterday. We had the benefit of four delegates, three of whom I believe were on the original committee. So we had the kind of interchange which I think is very valuable with the framers and others of us who were considering the constitutional article in retrospect of these past 20 years. The delegates who were there, Delegate White, Nordale, Barr, and Nerland, the discussants, Commissioner Gallagher, Frank Murkowski, Stan Erickson, Representative Cooper of the city. I think although I won't presume to say what the conclusion of the group was, we took no votes, nor I imagine did others. They were, I think one can say as a general statement, however, that the article, it's felt with its relative brevity, has stood up well in the dramatically different economic scene that we face in Alaska and have faced in the last 6 or 7 years, from the time that it was framed. And Commissioner Gallagher, by way of sort of side note in illustrating the impossibility almost of predicting the economic scene in Alaska by more than a year or so or even that, showed us that some of our perceptions of what has indeed happened in the last few years are incorrect as well. He gave us a chart which indicated, to my amazement, that per capita state expenditures, taking out inflation and considering inflation in the last 4 years, per capita state expenditures have been relatively flat. I think that was given us to show that some of our current day perceptions of our economic scene are substantially faulty. The article has not inhibited the kind of innovative tax and finance measures that have been needed to get through the last 3 or 4 years, principally, as a principal example given by Representative Cooper, the tax on reserves, a sort of a hybrid, quasi-borrowing in advance tax, which surely would have failed or not even have been proposed under the more restrictive and detailed provisions of other state constitutions on finance and borrowing. It was felt generally that the requirement of state and local government voted debt, which apparently was vigorously debated, at least as it was applied to local governments in Alaska, because apparently many delegates held that this was an intrusion on home rule and the power of local government to set their destiny just as they were framing it for the state. This requirement has really, it was felt, exercised only a modest check on state and local government borrowing, although there are signs today that it's a more significant provision, that perhaps its effect is now going to be greater than it has been since statehood. There was in the meeting, I think, no unanimity as to the value of the provision, and some delegates pointed out the fact that the voted debt requirement has indeed, in their view, spawned some borrowing vehicles, perhaps not contemplated by the framers of the Constitution, and of course they were talking about lease purchase debt of agencies such as the Alaska State Housing Authority. I think it's fair to say that the delegates were split on the question of the constitutional creation of a permanent fund. Generally speaking, those in attendance thought the idea of segregating away, if you will, for future generations, a percentage of non-renewable resource revenue was an attractive and compelling notion. However, they also felt that amending the anti-dedication provision of the Alaska State Constitution, which gives our legislature the power to deal with the whole quantum of dollars that flow into the state each year, that had to be viewed with great care, and that perhaps this was indeed a one-time exception only, if it was an acceptable amendment to put to the voters and for them to approve. Mr. Barry White noted, and this is a word I've heard used for the first time during this convention, that one cannot constitutionalize good government. Among his comments, he pointed out the possibility, at least, that the legislature, deprived of the appropriation power, over 25% of non-recurring oil revenue royalties, might be inclined to be less responsible with the balance. We dealt with, as I'm sure other sessions apparently did, the question of phase two, step two, administration of the fund if it's created, and just began to get into a consideration of whether that would be in the nature of a tri-party board with a direct executive, direct legislative, and perhaps direct elective officials. This was not, there was hardly any pursuit of this beyond simply that speculation and a recognition that the problem obviously will have to be addressed in great detail by the next legislature and perhaps the next two legislatures should this amendment pass. I would say there was a general perception, as apparently there is at this entire convention, of the importance of the vote and of its institutional significance for our Alaska state government. Turning to perhaps less immediate things, there was discussion of the possibility of alternate year budgeting, which is the case in some states. Some state constitutions either have done it as a modern device or have retained it as something that derives from less hectic days when biennial two-year sessions were appropriate. And I think at least some of the delegates indicated that the dynamics of the state's economy and the exigencies of budgeting for on an annual basis really indicated that alternate year budgeting was probably not a feasible alternative to the present Executive Budget Act and provision of the state constitution. Mr. Murkowski indicated the possibility that our uniformity or equality taxation article was perhaps too restrictive and that land speculative development and preservation of some farming systems might indicate some thought on the possible institution of differential taxation. The tension between the executive and legislative branches was noted in the finance and taxation area. I think some of the delegates, some of the people, discussants felt that there was a fairly wide realm of institutional reforms possible to the state legislature without amending the state constitution to mandate or achieve some of the institutional reforms. I would say on balance there was a real perception between the desire to live with a document as a living document, to fill in the interstices as they have been filled in with custom and usage, and a sense that there may be areas which, as this convention is addressing, which may need definite institutional reform. Although I must say that the delegates in general, those four who were with us, were pretty nearly uniformly of the view that anything very substantial was not indicated or called for. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric Wolforth. That was a very good summary. Now we'd like to call on Walter Parker, the state co-chairman of the State Federal Land Use Planning Commission, who will present the summary of the Natural Resources Workshop. Walt, would you come?
Thank you, Governor. In our consideration of Article 8, the Natural Resources Article in the Constitution, why we had a magnificent turnout. We had a strong panel and a large audience, of which there were at least 9 or 10 delegates represented, and we had plenty of time for everybody to get into the discussion. So we ranged over a rather wide field, which I'll do my best to summarize. In our considerations, we did try to keep it to Article 8 as much as possible without getting into the other areas, and we did have time to test all 18 sections in the article to some degree. The panel members were James Hurley, who set the stage as an original delegate, Robert Whedon, who professor of wildlife management here at the university, Guy Martin, the current commissioner of natural resources, Charles Herbert, the immediate past commissioner of natural resources, and Tim Wallace, who is president of Doyon Corporation now. The original intent of the framers of the Constitution in Article 8, as it came out in our discussions, were one, to promote the development, enhancement, conservation of the resources, and most of the delegates who spoke to that were very clear on that point, and two, to establish certain common rights to all Alaskan citizens in fisheries, water, land, and other resources. And we were able to test the whether the Constitution had worked in carrying forward these particular precepts, and also to test it against its ability to take care of the change that has occurred since it was written. In the three principal areas that came up there were the implications of the Native Claims Settlement Act, the implications of very high level of development, and the implications of the increased federal presence in Alaska, which was something that there was general agreement was not foreseen at the time the Constitution was written. The Constitution, one of the reasons for writing the Constitution was to diminish the federal presence, and speaking in the area of natural resources, there was a general consensus that the federal presence, rather than decreasing, had increased in several areas, and of course, that is due to the actions of the Congress during the 60s in passing the pollution control laws, the Environmental Protection Act, and now we've got several new acts on federal lands which brought a much higher level of land management and water management in the federal sector with which the state has had to wrestle. So I'll get getting back to the first two, the ability of the Constitution to do what is expressed in Article 8 in enhancing the development of the state's resources was felt that it had, there were no problems there, that it was able to do that. Very strong minority view was expressed by Dr. Whedon in that the impetus of Article 8 towards development is perhaps overstated for present conditions and should be modified so that the protection of the ecosystems which nourish the living resources, at least, could be better expressed, and also that the general quality of life desired by all Alaskans could be better expressed. And there was, you know, we've been debating this one for a long, long time in the state now, and there was absolutely no consensus reached as to which way we should proceed in Article 8, at least, in developing anything in this line. However, there were many, many people who did express some desire that the Constitution as a whole should be somewhat more visionary and express something that is more uniquely Alaskan. And as we stated it yesterday, at the time the Constitution was written, why, we were unique, and we didn't really need to reinforce that because we all knew it, and geography and the times very clearly expressed the uniqueness of the state. And now as we are getting drawn into these greater federal systems, why, possibly we do need to reinforce what Alaska is supposed to be all about in some language in the Constitution, but we certainly didn't even begin to come up with what that language should be, or in what article it should be even. As to the ability of the Constitution to guarantee common rights and fisheries and so forth. Of course, we've already had the one amendment in Article 8, the limited entry amendment, and this received some discussion, and some of the delegates came forward and had a hand in writing the original clauses and were very strongly against the amendment. They felt that this did inhibit the common right of fisheries to a degree that was certainly not envisioned in the Constitution at that time. And of course, we're going to vote on that again on November 2nd. But I think the one thing the dialogue did emphasize is the dangers that one runs in incorporating amendments into Article 8, especially amendments which do deal with the, very precisely with the allocations of the resources. And the general consensus there was that those sections which deal with minerals, both locatable and leasable, are good sections, and that good policy can be made from those sections by both the legislature and the executive, and there was no desire to really tamper with them. As Commissioner Martin expressed it, Section 11 does, the section dealing with locatable minerals, of course, is approaches being statute rather than constitutional provisions, but there's nothing in there that inhibits the commissioner or the governor from carrying out good policy. And of course, Article 12 dealing with leasable minerals is a good, solid, flexible article and has served us well during this period of intensive development of oil and gas. In dealing with the Native Claims Settlement Act, it was pointed out by the original delegates that they had discussed and strongly considered incorporating, well, not strongly, strongly is the wrong word, they had considered incorporating some language on Native claims in the Constitution. Consultants had been brought in, and it was their feeling that it was not the proper place, that this was a federal responsibility, and that was why it was not incorporated in the Constitution. And also, the record was set straight by several people that in those times, Native claims were not a primary consideration in Alaska or anywhere else in the nation. The whole body of civil rights that began to develop in the early 50s was just in its initial phases, and the times were simply, in the background, was simply not there for inserting any language dealing with Native claims in the original Constitution. The problems that have grown out that we must now wrestle with were identified as subsistence, and nobody has any constitutional language to deal with subsistence yet. I think the general feeling is that the present articles governing living renewable resources do allow us the flexibility to establish a subsistence policy within the state that will serve the needs of the rural and the urban residents both. The problem, of course, here once again is possible federal preemption and on some of the lands of the state, and it's one we're wrestling with right now, and I think there's a general consensus in the state that we want to keep regulation of our fish and game in state hands. At least that's the way it has come across to me in the last several years, and I think we're going to be able to carry the day in the Congress with this and retain regulatory control. But however, we've already had one further federal imposition in the 200-mile limit, which is going to bring a further federal role in the commercial fisheries, certainly outside 3 miles, but it's going to be very difficult. You know, you're not going to be able to separate at the 3-mile limit federal control from state control very precisely. What it amounts to is the federal government is going to have a great deal more involvement in the marine fisheries as a result of 200 miles. The the dealing with oil and gas, I've pretty well covered that. The general feeling was that the Article 8 does serve us well in a period of very high development of oil and gas, with once again the minority view that possibly the language is too strongly stated towards development. The on the increased federal presence, we're not able to come up with any constitutional language which is going to guarantee state rights on federal lands. We're looking at a situation where we'll have 103 million acres of state lands, assuming the state selects all of its lands, which is the intention now, 44 million acres of native lands, and the remaining 228 million acres of federal lands. And we're going to have a mix of federal managers on those lands, but as a result of the new BLM Organic Act, as a result of the new Forest Service Acts of 74, and good many and the other legislation I referred to earlier, we are facing a much increased level of federal management on that land, and that of course is going to impact upon state management, and we may even get into situations where the intent of the Constitution is impacted by those federal programs. And you know, we probably should examine the document to see if there is any language in there which could be inserted which would enable the state to hold forth its rights with the Congress and generally substantiate the state position. But we certainly didn't come up with any, and I think it would be an area that would be very difficult to wrestle with constitutionally. I certainly have given some thought to this, and it's the language that is in there now is very strong, and probably, unless somebody has a blinding flash of intuition, is going to have to serve us in this particular area. Well, the general wrap-up, the feeling was that no substantial amendments should be made to Article 8 at this time, with the exception of the limited entry, which of course is before us now. And at the most, we should consider some restructuring of language, but it's not worth opening up Article 8 for to the amendment process this time to achieve those changes in languages until we have a much clearer idea of what real philosophy we want to express in there. And we are talking about changes in philosophical expression and not changes in the structure of Article 8. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt. That was an interesting discussion of the activities of the members of the Natural Resources Workshop. And now, if there isn't too much objection from the delegates, we would like to deviate slightly from the way that the program has been set up and have Tom Stewart make his presentation now, and following him, Bill Casella. And then we felt that that would give the delegates a clear shot for the remainder of the time with their comments. It might work better. Tom, would you come? Yes. All right. If there's no objection, the meeting will stand at recess for 5 minutes. Thank you. We're about to proceed. Would the participants come into the room, please? It'd take 5 minutes to get them down here. Yeah? You bet that was good. Yeah. Uh-huh. We are about to proceed. If everyone will take their seats, please. Will the delegates please come down? Well, the meeting will come to order. We're about to proceed. If everyone will take their seats. It's my pleasure to present to you Thomas B. Stewart. Tom, as you know, was secretary of the Constitutional Convention back in 1955-66. He's now a Superior Court judge in the Southeast District. He'll speak to you of the Alaska Constitution and its effectiveness. Tom?
You know, there are many governors. They come and they go. But there is, and will be for a long time, for always, only one president of Alaska's first constitutional convention. So the only proper address is Mr. President. And friends of the Alaska Constitution. The purpose of this talk, which I'm going to make just as brief as I can in the view of the hour so that you can talk, is to make some overall evaluation of how well the Constitution has worked. You participants have done this on the panels, and they've been well reported, and they have covered many of the things that I would touch on, and therefore my remarks on them will be briefer. But perhaps those reports are in fragmented parts, and my effort is to point to more significant aspects of the entire document in operation, both positive and negative, and good and bad features. I may seem to give more concern to negative critical comments, but these are intended positively to suggest areas where improvement can be made. One must have some idea in the direction in which you're going. It reminds me of the New Yorker bound home the end of the day catching the Staten Island ferry, and he arrived at the dockside, and there was the ship about 10 feet from the wharf, and the water was churning up behind the propellers, and he took one mighty leap and landed on the dock, on the deck of the ship, flat on his face, picked himself up and said, "I made it." And the guy next to him said, "Yeah, mister, but this one's coming in." You have to have some idea where you're going. The method of evaluation that I sought to take is to raise questions. Of necessity, what I say to you will be largely subjective views on the issues discussed. They're not intended especially to persuade you to my views. I'm happy if they might do so, but more important, to challenge you consider the effectiveness of the Constitution, to broaden understanding of issues, and to act toward sufficiently important to do so. First, I think we should take a look at the purpose of the Constitution. We must know that to to determine a basic goal and whether or not it's been achieved. That purpose is to express the principles underlying government. The distinction should be made. It is not, in and of itself, government. It provides the rules for playing the game of government. Government is the action of the responsible leaders in carrying out those rules. The action of the legislature, the action of the executive, the action of the judiciary. There are basic things, in other words, to look for in an evaluation. How have those actions carried out the rules? What has been the record of the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary in its decisions? And what have been the actions of the people at large as a result of the existence of those basic principles? Have they been or have they not been good or bad? Your value judgment is at least equal to mine. These actions are the living flesh and blood fitting on the skeletal bones of that constitutional document. I've taken an outline rather like those of your panel, rather than strictly on the sections of the Constitution. First, in the area of the Bill of Rights and public responsibility. No area has produced anywhere near the volume of judicial decisions, the record of action so far as the Bill of Rights and those sections dealing with public responsibility, like on education and health and welfare, are largely expressed in judicial decisions. The judiciary is the prime arena for protecting the stated rights and defining their application to specific human problems. I can do little more than catalog a list of only just a few of the significant areas of decision, and somewhat less so, some maybe not significant but interesting decisions. In the inherent rights, the great area of equal rights and equal protection under the laws, this has often been addressed. The decisions have made clear that the Alaska Court not only must enforce the minimal constitutional statutes standards of the United States Constitution, but is free to develop additional constitutional rights and principles under our Constitution. And they have done so. The decisions are related to a wide variety of things, including, on the interesting rather than the more significant side, the rights of students to individual hairstyles, invalidating length of residency requirements for access to divorce courts, comparative punishments for crimes, the probability of special restrictions, the prohibiting of special restrictions on non-resident fishermen, and I mean only to intend the completely different subject matter that this right touches upon. In the area of civil rights, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, we have allowed, for example, the leasing by a city of its hospital facilities to a sectarian order to carry out public health purposes. There have been many decisions protecting the rights of freedom of speech. We have applied, has been applied in areas such as vague ordinances on public conduct, rights of assembly. In the equally critical area of due process of law, there have been a wide gamut of applications, especially in criminal cases, enforcement of administrative actions, application of the statutes, and so forth. The area of the grand jury has already been mentioned. I think myself that it is perhaps an anachronism. We have had no record in this land of the misuse of the prosecutorial power that I know. No substantial record of it. There could be an isolated case. And I think its utility should be questioned. It can be an instrument of delay and may often thwart the prompt determination of criminal matters rather than to aid them or to provide basic protection. There are other tools to protect against wrongful prosecution or a failure of prosecution. In the area of public responsibilities, I touch only lightly. I think that the simple, direct, clear, brief language that was adopted with respect to the educational system and health and welfare has served admirably to found the laws, the building of the executive branch agencies, and to express all the necessary basic principles to enable those systems to work in our society. Turning for a moment then to the legislative branch. Much has been made in the press and in the commentary in these sessions over the extended length of legislative sessions. And that is indeed a rightful concern. But as Jack Doyle said to you, is that truly a failure of the Constitution, of the language of Article 2? Or is it not rather a failure of leadership in the body to so order and arrange its affairs and to exert a self-discipline to accomplish the desired goal? Of shorter, better sessions. You may properly ask how this can be done and why it's not been done before. I would point first to a simple lesson from our own Constitutional Convention experience, and this is to give body to the recommendation that Jack Doyle made. The operation of the Committee of Committee Chairmen, which we called in the convention a steering committee, a committee to fix priorities, a committee whose members know at any one moment all of the legislation that's pending to be considered and its status. There is no such structure in our legislature today. Our rules have never provided for it. There is a fragmented leadership that cannot at any one moment determine the priorities, fix the goals, set the time schedules, and resolve the issues. The simple organization of a steering committee in each house, whose leadership met together between the houses and with the governor, could unquestionably, in my mind, do wonders in speeding the session, in focusing their actions on substantive issues, on getting rid of the nonsense, on fixing consent calendars for the end of each week to allow the myriad resolutions that mean nothing except to a legislator going home and to get rid of them in an hour instead of in 4 days. There's nothing wrong that I can see with the article. There is only a lack of imagination, a lack of pre-consideration and planning for leadership in the operation of that body. The rules need to be revamped to limit autocratic action by committee chairmen who willfully sit on bills and will not move them except by trades. There's nothing except a bad tradition that establishes that in the practice of our legislature, a tradition that can be changed by enlightened leadership. There is that desperate need for an imaginative address to the problems of moving legislation. The Constitution itself is fully adequate. Turning to the executive branch, the wisdom of the so-called strong executive is not a matter on which I intend to dwell at any length. It has been treated more than fully in the panel reports. Suffice it to say that I must disagree totally with the views expressed by Mr. President yesterday evening. I'm reminded of a law professor that I had, who was a wonderful old German gentleman who spoke with a thick accent, and when the student gave the wrong answer to the question, his response was, "You couldn't be wronger." And that's the only reply that I can give to that proposition, which is a reflection not of the weakness of the Constitution,
But here, as foreign as it may be to my Democratic soul, I must adopt the proposition of Governor Hickel that it requires only strong leadership to carry out those provisions adequately. With respect to the judicial branch, it seemed to me it was to all of you and many of you here, our delegates, it would be interesting to recall an anecdote, a bit of history of the convention about which even some of the delegates might not be aware. Let me preface it by saying I've been somewhat uniquely privileged to view the problems of other states. For 5 years, I was the court administrator for the state of Alaska and met in each of those years on one or two occasions in each year with the National Conference of Court Administrators and saw at first hand the utterly frustrating problems of the operation of the judiciary in those states that are not blessed with an unified judiciary with the central administration. Throughout the nation, amongst all of those administrators, we are the envy of those burdened with archaic judicial organizations who lack in the unified administrative system. I must again say to my dear friend Bill, President Bill, with regard to an elective system of judges, that you couldn't be wronger. It would be a tragedy of the worst sort to destroy the independence of the judiciary with the result of producing decisions catering to the vagaries of passing popular whims. Just 2 weeks ago, one of the finest judges in King County, Washington, lost his seat, and the prime qualifications of his challenger in the election were that he had a TV personality and no legal ability, respected by the bar, people that knew him at all. There is, I think, however, definitely a degree to which the system of the selection of judges can and should be questioned as to its effectiveness. And here I turn to the anecdote of the convention. I'm not sure how many of you remember the incident. It was about 2 weeks before the end of the convention. The consultants who were then present were John Bebout and two departed, E. Mulsady and Kimbrough Owen. They're highly professional people. Their success as consultants might be attributed to their understanding that their place was not to try to tell you what you should do, but simply to attempt to see that you knew the alternatives. You knew the consequences of choosing one or another, and that in your decision, in making your decision, it would be an informed decision. For that reason, they assiduously avoided and often spoke with me as sort of chief of the staff about the sensitivity of their position and not saying what they thought ought to be. But there came a time, about 2 weeks before the end of the convention, where they felt the necessity to speak up. They came to me and asked, how could this be managed? My suggestion was that they set down on paper their views as to the areas in which they thought there was weakness, and to go to the president and ask for the opportunity to appear before that steering committee of which I have spoken, and to lay out to them in confidence in a closed session their concerns about what they felt were errors. And then the committee chairman, if they wished, could take it back to the body and reconsider. Well, I want just to read to you briefly their comment about the manner of the selection of judges. And in order to make that intelligible, I'll have to refer to the sections involved in Article 4. They are Section 5, which says, the governor shall fill any vacancy in an office of Supreme Court Justice or Superior Court Judge by appointing one of two or more persons nominated by the Judicial Council. In Section 8, the Judicial Council consists of seven members, 3 attorney members shall be appointed for 6-year terms by the governing body of the organized state bar. That phrase, governing body, is fairly critical. 3 non-attorney members shall be appointed for 6-year terms by the governor, subject to confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session. That's the critical language. Here, and I quote, is the comment of the consultants. Sections 5 and 8. These and other sections lay the basis for a strong and independent judiciary, which is desirable. These sections in particular, however, go a long way toward withdrawing the judicial branch from the control of the people of the state and placing it under that of the organized bar. No state constitution has ever gone this far in placing one of the 3 coordinate branches of the government beyond the reach of democratic controls. We feel that it's in its desire to preserve the integrity of the courts. The convention has gone farther than is necessary or safe in putting them in the hands of a private professional group, however public-spirited its members may be. We suggest a number of ways which, singly or in combination, would provide for a greater degree of public control without jeopardizing the independence of the judiciary. A, require the Judicial Council to nominate 3 or more instead of 2 or more persons. B, provide that the governor shall appoint each attorney member of the Judicial Council from at least 3 nominees of the organized bar. C, require that attorney members of the Judicial Council be confirmed by the legislature, as in the case of lay members. D, add 1 Superior Court judge and 1 more lay member to the Judicial Council. This change by itself would not accomplish much, but it might have the effect of diluting slightly the control of the council by a professional group. I don't know how many of you, nor how many of the citizens of Alaska, really remember the history of how the First Judicial Council was chosen and how they reached their nominations of the first judges. Now, I pause to say here that I think we were indeed fortunate in the names of those first judges. I can't complain. Governor Bill offered an appointment to me at that time, which I did not accept. But early in June of 1959, when it became clear that we had to proceed with the organization of the judiciary, there was a meeting of the Board of Governors of the State Bar Association in Nome. There was no one in attendance except the members of the Board of Governors. There had been no statute to implement the language of the Constitution to suggest, for example, whether the governing body of the bar, as noted in that phrase, was indeed the Board of Governors, or whether it might not have been the convention of the entire bar, who might have nominated the Judicial Council members by a nominating process in the bar convention and having all the members of the bar who turned out for the convention vote on who should be the council, who should be the attorney members of the bar. Mind you, friends of the Constitution, that's a critical decision, who are going to be your judges, and most of them are for their professional lives, regardless of the retention elections. I was the executive secretary of that council for some 5 years and watched intimately its operations. By and large, the attorney members manipulated its affairs. Here and there were extremely effective lay members. By and large, it took some time for them to become oriented to the process and to be able to assert themselves. And I might, for your personal interest as delegates, say to you that one of the more effective members of that council over the years was one of your own, John Cross. But there in Nome, early in June of 1959, by the manipulations of a bare majority of the Board of Governors, who asserted to themselves the function, the naming of the first 12 judges was accomplished. And since then, it has been a fairly closed affair. In my judgment, as a member of the bar and as a member of the judiciary, too much dominated by the bar. And some consideration of amending the process to include perhaps some of these recommendations that the delegates gave to us might well return to a more representative group the power to nominate and the prevention of manipulation. That manipulation, in the case of some judgeships, not all, for example, has been exercised by nominating a strong member, a strong nominee, and a weak nominee, so that the governor was left with little real choice, when there were other fairly strong nominees available to the council in their consideration. Another aspect of weakness is that the nominees to judgeships have come, and this is a matter of tradition, as has been said here before, a lot of the flesh and blood has come from tradition. Those nominees are determined by writing a letter to the bar and asking for applications. Any self-starter may be considered for a judgeship. And it seems to me that the Judicial Council itself can improve its practices to be more selective in the names that it considers. In perusing the list of all the attorney members and asking those who by repute appear more qualified to be considered as candidates. Perhaps I've dwelt too long on the problems of the judicial branch, but some of these things that I have said, I think, are not often viewed by the public, and yet they are terribly important to the system of justice under which we live. The local government article. In my judgment, in many, many ways, it has been the least effectively well executed, though perhaps the best in concept, in terms of rendering into the hands of the people the capacity to govern themselves. The delay in recognizing and acting upon on it initially for its expressed purpose, and I quote to you, I think verbatim, its real expressed purpose. It appears in the first sentence of Section 1 of Article 11, and it says, quote, "The purpose of this article is to provide the maximum local self-government with a minimum of governmental units," unquote. Now, the minimum is one, not two. And it took our capital city 10 years to recognize that, wasting its energy in internecine warfare between the borough and the city. And 16 years for our largest city to do the same. And that's shameful when the simple proposition is there boldly to see in the first sentence that you read in the article. That, again, to me, is an expression not a failure of the article of the Constitution, but of our leadership in not recognizing the purpose and the need. It's a simple proposition. Our old city boundaries are horse and buggy boundaries. They were drawn close to a center because you never traveled more than where a horse and buggy would take you. And we live in an automobile age, and the boundary should be 50 miles out from the center in almost any community that you speak of that has any road at all, because that's the land surface that the people in the center use, and the boundaries of the local government should be there. And it's as simple as that. And in that area, there should be only one government with the focus of the energies of its leaders on the real business of how to allocate your resources to accomplish the schools and the roads and the police and the health system, rather than in fighting between personalities who sit on top of semi-autonomous governmental power. A large cause for that weakness the failure of both the legislative and the executive branches to see and act on the need for a truly strong department, cabinet-level department of community and regional affairs. Now, that department should have three principal charges or missions. It should be provide, and I quote them not in the order of priority necessarily. It should be providing professional services to the small towns and the villages. Those villages have not the capacity to hire full-time engineers, lawyers, medical people, accountants, the range of professional services. And the state could do so much in fixing regional centers with professional people there to serve the villages in that region, to help draft the ordinances, to provide the services that those communities need. Secondly, a staff to develop programs to encourage proper government of metropolitan areas. A professional staff could have worked with the mayors and the council members of the cities to design good local government years ago. And finally, to administer government in what have been described as the interstices, the unorganized borough, where there is no corporate organization to do so. The article has not been effective, but not because of deficiencies of the Constitution, but rather a lack of imagination and understanding and vigor in its administration. Simply because we had no history of such an agency, there hasn't until recently been one, and it's still a stepchild, and it should not be. A moment on finance and taxation. And I'll refer just one moment again to the consultant's report, which was very brief in this area. It has to do with voting on bond issues. We feel that it is unwise to prevent the legislature from borrowing money without a costly and time-consuming referendum, even when almost all members are agreed on the urgency of financing a capital improvement. Our bonded indebtedness is a tragedy, in my judgment. I have the statement here. We owe $500 million at the moment, and it costs us this year $35 million in interest to have borrowed that money. And which among you, as voters, really knew the priorities of the projects that established that debt, as against other possible projects, as against the others that had been voted? We should be much safer, in my judgment, much wiser in establishing priorities, in determining which bond issues ought to be made, which should not, if that responsibility were placed squarely upon the shoulders of the legislature. Today, the legislature passes out the issues without responsibility, without critical examination of the priorities, without how it mounts this debt, without planning of what has to come in the future, because it's passed on to the people. The people are called upon to vote upon them in ignorance. They not only do not know what the existing debt structure is and what the impact on it will be of the proposed bond issue, they don't know anything about the program that will have to function in the new facility. Maybe a university building. How many professors? How much operational cost? This is not to suggest that I have any opposition to particular bond issues, but simply that the present system is inadequate to make a reasoned judgment on the priorities. Two other short matters. Okay, I'm going to wind up right now. I won't touch on the natural resource article. It's been well covered in the presentation of the panel. The matter of direct legislation. And I say to you that it's too easy, that the legislation that we have had from the referendum and the initiative is bad legislation. It does not get critical consideration by the voters. There is no chance to amend it when the errors of it are written into the proposition, and it's too easy. It's an area for consideration. I've been negative, but with you, I share an ultimate pride in the beauty of that document and its clarity and simplicity. As an officer of your convention, believe me, it was frustrating not to be able to speak when it was framed, and I appreciate the privilege at this hour to have done so.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. You know, before calling our next speaker, I'd like to observe that it's certainly amusing to me how stories get changed in the telling. And Mr. Stewart referred to the fact that he did not accept a judgeship in 1959. He was anxious for that judgeship, but he refused to accept the strong executive's decision as to where he should serve. You know, too, before calling him Mr. Casella, it's amazing to me what this art of disguise in the 20th century, what happens. First, it was Maynard Longberg the other night. I had a difficult time recognizing him. And then this morning, I saw a fellow sitting over here, and I've been trying to figure out who it was until just now I recognized the distinguished former Attorney General of Alaska, John Hathaway. John, it's nice to have you with us. But we do have with us a very distinguished American, a man who is the executive director of the National Municipal League. Bill Casella is among those that follows many of those who were with us at the time of the drafting of the constitutional document in 1955 and 66. We're all pleased and honored to have you here with us, Bill. We're anxious to hear you.
Governor, it's my privilege to be here. I can't tell all of you how delighted I've been to be a part of this